A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been doing some digital spring cleaning. He finally made the switch back to Firefox after years of Chrome lock-in, but he's been using Mozilla's other stuff for ages. Monitor, Thunderbird, even contributed voice clips to some open library they're building. His question is basically, who are these people? Who founded Mozilla? What drove them to become the internet's privacy conscience? And what else are they doing that nobody talks about?
The voice library is Common Voice. It's brilliant. We'll get there. But you're right. Most people think Mozilla is Firefox, and that's the end of the story. The reality is so much stranger and more interesting.
Stranger how?
The name. Mozilla. It's a portmanteau of Mosaic and Godzilla.
I'm sorry.
Mosaic was the first graphical web browser. Early 90s, the one that made the web visible to normal humans, and Godzilla because they wanted to be the monster that ate the competition. The internal code name for Netscape Navigator was Mozilla, and when they open-sourced the browser code in 1998, the name stuck.
So, the organization that today publishes a manifesto about internet decency and human dignity named itself after a radioactive lizard.
A portmanteau of a radioactive lizard. And this is what I love about the origin story. It wasn't some pristine nonprofit born in the university lab. It came out of a corporate death spiral. Netscape was losing the browser war to Microsoft's Internet Explorer, which was bundled with Windows and eating the market alive. By early 1998, Netscape was desperate. So they did something unprecedented. They threw their entire browser source code onto the internet and said, "Here, it's yours now."
That's not how companies usually respond to losing.
The announcement came on January 22, 1998. Netscape released the code under a new kind of license, the Mozilla Public License, and created the Mozilla organization to steward it. The idea was that a global community of developers would improve the code faster than any single company could, and that an open browser would prevent any one player from controlling the web.
Which at the time meant Microsoft.
Which at the time absolutely meant Microsoft. Internet Explorer had something like 95% market share by the early 2000s. The fear was real. If one company controls the browser, that company controls how everyone experiences the internet. And if that company also makes the operating system, you've got a vertical monopoly on digital life.
So Mozilla was born as a defensive weapon.
A defensive weapon that didn't work very well at first. The early Mozilla code was a mess. Netscape had been building on top of years of legacy code, and when it hit the open source community, a lot of developers took one look and ran. It took years to rebuild the rendering engine from scratch. That became Gecko, which still powers Firefox today.
But the organization itself changed shape during all this.
Dramatically, the Mozilla organization was initially just a loose group within Netscape. Then AOL bought Netscape in 1999, and things got complicated. By 2003, AOL was winding down its browser division entirely. That's when the Mozilla Foundation was created, July 15, 2003, as an independent nonprofit. Mitchell Baker, who'd been one of the original Netscape lawyers working on the open source release, became the president.
A lawyer at the helm of an open source project.
And she's been central to Mozilla's identity ever since. Baker wrote a lot of what became the Mozilla Manifesto, published in 2007, 10 principles. The first one, the internet is a global public resource that must remain open and accessible.
That's a statement of values, not a product roadmap.
And that's the key to understanding everything Mozilla does. The manifesto isn't window dressing. Principle 5 says individuals must have the ability to shape the internet and their own experiences on it. That directly informs Firefox's enhanced tracking protection, which blocks third-party trackers by default. It's not a feature they bolted on because privacy was trendy. It's an implementation of a philosophical commitment they made 17 years ago.
Walk me through how that tracking protection actually works. What's being blocked?
third-party cookies, fingerprinting scripts, crypto miners, tracking content in general. When you visit a site, Firefox maintains a list from Disconnect, a partner organization of known tracking domains. If a script from one of those domains tries to load, Firefox just says no. The standard setting blocks trackers in private windows. The strict setting blocks them everywhere. And starting a few years ago, they introduced Total Cookie Protection, which isolates cookies to the site that created them. So the ad network can't follow you from the shoe store to the news site.
That's a technical solution to a business model problem.
Right, the business model of surveillance advertising. And Mozilla's structural setup lets them do this without a conflict of interest. Here's the thing most people don't realize. The Mozilla Foundation is a nonprofit, and it owns the Mozilla Corporation, which is a taxable for-profit entity. The corporation develops Firefox and makes money, mostly from search engine deals, Google paying to be the default search in Firefox. But the corporation answers to the foundation, and the foundation answers to the manifesto. Profit serves mission, not the other way around.
How much money are we talking about?
Mozilla's annual revenue has been in the hundreds of millions, north of 400 million some years, mostly from that Google search deal. But they've been diversifying. They launched a VPN service. They have premium products now. The point is, they have enough money to fund all these other projects we're about to discuss, and they don't have shareholders demanding they monetize user data.
Let's talk about those other projects. Daniel mentioned the voice library.
Common Voice. Launched in 2017. Here's the problem it solves. Voice recognition technology is trained on massive datasets of human speech. Those datasets are owned by Google, Amazon, Apple, Microsoft. If you want to build a voice assistant or a transcription tool, you either pay one of those companies for API access or you're locked out. And if you speak a language that isn't commercially interesting, say Welsh or Catalan or Swahili, good luck. The big companies haven't collected enough data to serve you.
So Mozilla decided to build their own dataset and give it away.
And make it the largest publicly available voice dataset in the world. They've collected over 20,000 hours total across more than 100 languages. Anyone can contribute by reading sentences aloud through the website or the app. Anyone could download the dataset and use it to train models. It's released under CC0, public domain. No restrictions.
Daniel said he contributed readings.
That's exactly how it works. You go to the Common Voice site, you see a sentence, you read it into your microphone. Then other users validate the clips, they listen and confirm the reading matches the text. It's a community quality control system. The dataset grows through small contributions from thousands of people.
What's the practical impact? Who's actually using this data?
Researchers, startups, language preservation groups. There's a project in New Zealand using Common Voice to build Maori speech recognition. African language technologists are building tools for languages that Google and Apple have ignored. The Mozilla Foundation has been running language deep dives, focused campaigns to collect data for underrepresented languages. It's infrastructure for linguistic sovereignty.
That's a phrase I didn't expect to hear today.
But it's accurate. If speech recognition only works for the world's 20 biggest languages, you've created a two-tier internet where billions of people can't speak to their devices in their native language. Common Voice is Mozilla saying, that's not acceptable, and we're going to fix it ourselves.
Daniel also mentioned Mozilla Monitor. What's that?
Data breach notifications. You give Monitor an email address. It checks that address against known data breaches. Have I been pwned is the underlying database, and tells you if your credentials have been exposed. It's free. It also has a premium tier that scans for your personal information on data broker sites and helps you request removals.
Have I Been Pwned is run by Troy Hunt, right? That's not a Mozilla project.
Correct. Mozilla partnered with him. The value Mozilla adds is integration and accessibility. Firefox now has built-in breach alerts. If you're using Firefox and a site you've saved credentials for shows up in a breach, you get a notification right in the browser. They also offer a dashboard where you can monitor multiple email addresses and get guidance on what to do after a breach. Most people don't know how to check if they've been breached. Mozilla Monitor puts it in front of them, in the browser they're already using, with clear language. Same philosophy, transparency, user control, no surprises.
Thunderbird's in the mix too.
Thunderbird is the email client that refuses to die, and I mean that as a compliment. It started as part of the Mozilla suite back in 2003, got spun off, nearly got abandoned, and then in 2020 was moved to a wholly owned Mozilla subsidiary called MZLA Technologies. It's still open source, still free, still built on open standards. No tracking, no ads, no, we read your email to serve you better. It just handles email.
In a world where Gmail reads your receipts and Outlook injects ads, that's almost radical.
It is radical. Thunderbird supports OpenPGP encryption out of the box now. It's got a calendar, task management, chat, and because it's open source, there's an extension ecosystem. People build what they need. It's not flashy, but it's durable.
All right, we've covered the browser, the voice library, the breach monitor, the email client. What else is hiding in Mozilla's portfolio that people don't know about?
MDN WebDocs. It's the reference documentation for web developers, HTML, CSS, JavaScript, web APIs. If you've ever built anything for the web, you probably landed on an MDN page. Mozilla maintains it in partnership with Google, Microsoft, and other contributors, but Mozilla started it and still drives it. It's arguably the single most important educational resource for web development.
That's not a product exactly. It's public infrastructure.
And that's the pattern. Mozilla builds public infrastructure. They also did Rust. Do you know Rust?
The programming language everyone won't stop talking about.
That's the one. Rust was originally a Mozilla research project, started by Graydon Hoare in 2006 and sponsored by Mozilla starting in 2009. The first stable release was in 2015. It was designed to solve problems Mozilla was having with Firefox's C++ code, memory safety bugs, concurrency issues. Rust prevents entire classes of bugs at compile time. It's now used in the Linux kernel, in Android, in Windows, in AWS infrastructure. Mozilla spun off the Rust Foundation in 2021, but the language exists because Mozilla funded a decade of development for a tool that made their browser better and then gave it to the world.
That's a pattern too. Build something to solve your own problem, then release it for everyone.
And the problem was security. Memory safety bugs account for something like 70% of critical vulnerabilities in large code bases. Rust eliminates those by design. So Mozilla's commitment to security isn't just about blocking trackers, it's about building the underlying tools that make software safer at the language level.
What about their advocacy work? You mentioned net neutrality earlier.
Mozilla has been one of the most consistent voices for net neutrality in the US and globally. They filed amicus briefs in the major FCC cases. They've pushed back against encryption backdoors repeatedly. When the ER and ID Act was floating around Congress threatening to undermine Section 230 and encryption, Mozilla was leading campaigns against it. They run a fellowship program that funds technologists working on internet health issues, misinformation, digital inclusion, AI ethics.
And now, AI. That's the new frontier.
They launched Mozilla.ai in 2023, a startup and a community focused on trustworthy, open-source AI. The idea is to build AI that's transparent, that respects privacy, that doesn't require handing all your data to a handful of companies. They've invested $30 million in it. They're working on things like local AI models that run on your device instead of in the cloud.
So the same playbook applied to the current threat.
Exactly the same playbook. In 1998, the threat was Microsoft controlling the browser. In 2026, the threat is a handful of companies controlling the AI models that increasingly mediate how we access information. Mozilla's response is structurally identical. Open source alternatives, user control, transparency, and a business model that doesn't depend on surveillance.
There's a tension here, though. Firefox's market share has been declining for years. Chrome dominates. On mobile, Safari and Chrome split the field. Does Mozilla have the leverage to actually shape AI the way they shape the browser market?
That's the uncomfortable question. Firefox is down to something like 3% of the desktop browser market. On mobile, it's even lower. The Google search deal that funds most of Mozilla's work is... Well, Google pays to be the default in a browser that relatively few people use. If that deal ever goes away, and there are regulatory pressures that could affect it, Mozilla's financial model gets shaky fast.
So the entire mission rests on a revenue stream that depends on the goodwill of a company whose business model Mozilla explicitly opposes.
I wouldn't say goodwill. Google pays Mozilla because it's worth it to them. It provides competitive cover. Google can point to Firefox and say, see, there's browser competition. Mozilla has been trying to diversify revenue for years. the VPN, the premium monitor tier, Pocket. They're building a portfolio. But the search deal is still the majority of their income.
Does that undercut the mission?
I don't think so, because the structure protects it. The foundation controls the corporation. The manifesto is legally embedded in the corporate governance. Even if the money comes from Google, the decisions about what to build and what principles to uphold are made by people who are legally obligated to prioritize the mission. It's not perfect, no funding model is, but it's better than being beholden to shareholders or advertisers.
Let's go back to something you mentioned earlier. The open source release of Netscape in 1998. That was a desperation move, but it created an entire ecosystem. Firefox, Thunderbird, Rust, Common Voice. That's a lot of downstream impact from one dying company's Hail Mary.
And it almost didn't work. The early years were rough. The Mozilla suite was bloated and slow. It wasn't until 2002 that a group of developers decided to fork the browser component and build something lean and fast. That became Phoenix, then Firebird, then finally Firefox in 2004. The first Firefox release was a revelation. Tabbed browsing, pop-up blocking, a search bar built in. It was fast. Within 9 months, it had been downloaded 60 million times.
60 million downloads in 9 months? That's not nothing.
By 2009, Firefox had something like 32% of the global browser market. It broke Internet Explorer's monopoly. It proved that open source development could produce a consumer product that normal people wanted to use. And it forced Microsoft to improve Internet Explorer, which they'd basically abandoned after winning the browser war.
Competition worked.
Competition worked. But then Chrome arrived in 2008, backed by Google's marketing machine and pre-installed on Android devices, and the cycle started again. The difference now is that Mozilla has diversified. Even if Firefox's market share keeps shrinking, the other projects, Common Voice, MDN, Rust, the advocacy work, those have independent value. Mozilla isn't just a browser company anymore. It hasn't been for a long time.
All right, I want to circle back to the manifesto. You said it has 10 principles. We've talked about the first one. What are the others that actually shape decisions?
Principle 3. The internet should enrich the lives of individual human beings. That's the standard they hold features against. Does this actually help people, or does it just extract value from them? Principle 4. Individual security and privacy on the internet are fundamental and must not be treated as optional. That's the encryption fights, the anti-tracking, the pushback against surveillance. Principle 6. The effectiveness of the internet as a public resource depends upon interoperability, innovation, and decentralized participation worldwide. That's the open standards work, the commitment to protocols over platforms.
These sound good on paper. How do you test whether they're real?
You look at what they don't do. Mozilla doesn't sell user data. They don't build an ad network. They don't accept investments that would compromise their independence. When they launched sponsored tiles on the Firefox new tab page, there was an uproar from the community, and they walked it back and redesigned it with clearer privacy protections. The accountability mechanism is the community itself, plus the nonprofit governance structure.
Speaking of the community, Daniel's part of it now. He's contributed voice clips to Common Voice. He's using Monitor. He's on Thunderbird. What does that actually mean, to be a Mozilla contributor rather than just a user?
It depends on the project. With Common Voice, you're literally building the training data. Every validated clip becomes part of a data set that anyone can use. With code contributions, Mozilla has a whole ladder. You start by fixing bugs, then you can become a module owner or a peer reviewer. With something like MDN, you can contribute documentation. The point is that Mozilla isn't a walled garden. The boundary between user and contributor is porous by design.
That's a very different model from click here to accept the terms of service.
It's the difference between citizenship and consumerism. Mozilla treats users as citizens of the internet with rights and responsibilities. Most tech companies treat users as consumers whose attention is the product. That's not a rhetorical flourish. It's encoded in the governance structure. The Mozilla Foundation is a nonprofit. Its board isn't answerable to shareholders. The manifesto is the constitution.
You're making it sound almost civic.
It is civic. The internet is public infrastructure, whether we acknowledge it or not. The roads and bridges of the 21st century are protocols and platforms. Mozilla's argument, And I think they're right, is that public infrastructure needs public stewardship. You wouldn't hand all the roads to one company and let them decide who can drive on them and what they can see along the way.
That metaphor actually lands.
Thank you. I've been workshopping it.
Of course you have. All right. Before we wrap up the main discussion, what's the biggest thing Mozilla has failed at? What should they've done that they didn't?
Mobile. Mozilla tried with Firefox OS, a full mobile operating system built on web technologies. It launched in 2013, targeted emerging markets, had partnerships with carriers in Latin America and Eastern Europe. The idea was brilliant, an open mobile OS where every app was essentially a web app, no walled garden, no app store monopoly. It failed commercially. They shut it down in 2016.
Why did it fail?
The app ecosystem never materialized. Developers didn't build for it because users weren't on it, and users weren't on it because the apps weren't there. Classic chicken and egg problem. Plus, Android was already free and dominant in the markets Mozilla was targeting. It was a noble attempt, but the window had closed.
And the connected devices play? What was that?
WebThings, an open platform for smart home devices built on web standards. You could run a gateway on a Raspberry Pi and control lights and sensors through a web interface, no cloud dependency, no vendor lock-in. It was technically elegant and commercially irrelevant. They handed it off to the community in 2020.
So they keep trying to build open alternatives in markets where closed systems have already won.
And that's either quixotic or visionary, depending on how you look at it. The failures matter because they show Mozilla actually tries things. They're not just a think tank publishing white papers. They build real products, ship them, and sometimes they fail. The successes, Firefox, Rust, Common Voice, MDN, those are the ones that stuck.
Hilbert, you've been quiet. You've got that look.
I was a QA tester for a web startup in 2001. Little outfit in Austin. We built online survey tools, ran on Netscape's codebase.
Wait, you were working with the pre-Firefox Mozilla code?
The Mozilla application suite. We built our whole platform on it. I tested it every day for 18 months.
How was that?
Lost a week of work once. Whole week. Browser crashed during a save and corrupted the profile. Back then, there was no session restore, just a dialog box and regret.
That's the early Mozilla experience in a nutshell.
People talk about open source like it's noble. It was also bugs. Thousands of bugs. We filed so many Bugzilla tickets, the Mozilla people knew my name. I'd call about a rendering issue and they'd say, Hilbert, we know, we're working on it.
Did it ever get stable?
Firefox 1.0. That was the turning point. We migrated everything. The difference was night and day. But I kept using Thunderbird for email because by then I didn't trust anything that came out of Redmond.
You'd use it?
Every morning. It's the only email client that doesn't make me feel like a product on a shelf.
That's a good line.
Not trying to be clever. It just doesn't scan my messages to sell me things. I appreciate that.
Daniel mentioned contributing to Common Voice. Have you ever...
I submitted a clip. They rejected it.
Oh.
Cat meowed in the background, right in the middle of the sentence. The quick brown fox jumps over the lazy meow. Validation flagged it. Got an email saying my contribution didn't meet quality standards.
That's the community validation system working exactly as designed.
I know. Still stung a little.
You got rejected by a voice library.
My cat got rejected by a voice library. I was just a delivery mechanism.
Does it try again?
I put the cat in the other room and recorded 5 more. They all passed. So somewhere in the Common Voice dataset, there's a man from Austin reading sentences about weather and grocery lists.
That's genuinely nice.
The thing about Mozilla, and I've been watching them since before they were Mozilla, is that they're still here. My startup lasted 4 years. Netscape is gone. AOL is a ghost. Internet Explorer is a punchline. Mozilla is still shipping. Still annoying the big companies. I respect the longevity.
Do you think they'll survive the AI era?
They survived Microsoft at 95% market share. They'll figure something out. Whether it matters, that's a different question.
What do you mean?
The web was new in 98. You could still shape it. AI is already shaped. The big models are trained. The data centers are built. The money is spent. Mozilla's trying to build open alternatives, and I hope they succeed. But they're starting from behind this time. Not like the browser wars. Back then, they were the alternative to a monopoly. Now they're the alternative to 5 monopolies.
That's grim.
I'm not trying to be grim, just saying the hill is steeper. but they've climbed steep hills before.
Hilbert, do you still have that old startup's code anywhere?
On a zip disk in a box in my closet. Haven't had a zip drive since 2004, but I can't bring myself to throw it out.
A zip disk. That's a format I haven't thought about in 20 years.
100 megabyte capacity. Felt like the future.
The future is now a paperweight.
Everything becomes a paperweight eventually. That's why you build things that outlast the hardware.
Mozilla's been thinking about the open internet for 28 years. That's a long time to stay focused on one mission. Most companies pivot every 6 months. Mozilla is still fighting the same fight, just with different tools. I find that remarkable.
The open question is whether that mission-driven model can hold against the economic gravity of AI. Data is the new oil, as everyone loves to say, and Mozilla's whole philosophy is that data should belong to users, not platforms. That's a tough position when the dominant AI business model is collect everything and train on it.
But that's also why Mozilla.ai exists. They're trying to prove that you can build useful AI without harvesting user data. Local models, federated learning, open datasets. If they can make it work technically and economically, they create a path that other organizations can follow. That's always been the play, not to win the market, but to prove an alternative is possible.
And if they can't?
Then we still have Common Voice and Rust and Firefox and the manifesto as a document that says what the internet should be, even when it isn't. That matters too. Standards matter even when they're aspirational.
This has been My Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop, who once got rejected by a voice library and is still thinking about it.
If you want to contribute to Common Voice yourself, head to commonvoice.mozilla.org. Read some sentences. Keep the cat out of the room.
Find us at myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.